You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
As you listen to this podcast, the 47th President of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump, has completed 100 days in office. And what 100 days it's been. It doesn't matter whether you like him or you hate him. You have to say he's a great source of fascination to more or less everybody. It's a difficult job that Philip Saunders, director at the Investment Institute at 91 in London, and I have today, because you can't talk about Donald Trump without certain personal passions about how he goes about his business come to the surface. But I'm going to try. I know Philip's going to try. And what we're going to do is give him a 100-day, almost like a school report, on the various things that he's done to the financial markets and geopolitical markets and so forth. Philip, that's me saying let's not argue about Donald Trump and let's not indulge ourselves in partisan politics, please. Can you do that?
Well, I can just about do that, I'm sure.
All right, let's try. let's start with the obvious one then, and that is the equities markets, notably the US market. When he came to power, they were pretty buoyant, and I think they peaked something like February the 13th. And when he started opening his mouth about various things that some people didn't like, in fact, most market participants didn't like, because that was the peak of the stock market. And from high to low, the S&P fell nearly 20%, and they were troubling times. It was the worst start to a presidential residency in history when it came to stock market performance. Maybe you could sort of outline your theories on this. Was it ripe for the picking already? Was it Trump related? Did one man do all this?
Well, I think that we've got to remember that that we were in a momentum market, a strong momentum market before Trump was elected. There was then a wave of euphoria because when he was previously president, he was clearly, he's pro-deregulation, he's pro-business, he's anti-regulation, etc. And so that just extended this strong momentum move, which was led, as we know, by a pretty narrow group of stocks. And the market was sort of particularly buoyant. Also, there were seasonal effects because at the end of the year, you get the Christmas rally and so forth, and this was no exception, a particularly strong one. And that all carried through until February. And then he went and spoiled it all from an equity investor's perspective. But come on, there was going to be a correction at any rate. That's certainly what we felt when we had to write the outlook. The US market was getting overextended. This particular bull run was mature. And these market cycles, you have corrective phases. Markets get ahead of themselves in any event. And it may well be there's a sort of particular trigger that determines the timing of a correction and possibly its severity. But it's part of the sort of normal behavior of markets. So we shouldn't sort of get too carried away about that. And sort of, you know, pointing a finger at Trump as being basically sort of spoiling the party. The party was going to get spoiled at any rate at some point.
Yes, so, it was. But on the other hand, the naysayers, when it comes to Trump's very sort of muscular political stance in various areas, would say as soon as he stood up with that board in the Rose Garden that day, that hastily scribbled a board about with all the countries and what he was going to do to them, the market was closed, of course. He made sure of that, but the markets never close. So as soon as the futures markets opened at midnight Central European time, they started ticking lower. They were 2% down. And then by the end of the day, the real session the next day, they were down anything between 5% and 7%, depending on your chosen index. Then I thought, well, that's it, a bit of a washout, and that was it. But no, that was the Thursday. The Friday, same again, except worse. And I thought, this is something completely different. And the complete difference factor was Donald Trump, I believe.
Sure. So you've got to remember that, in fact, actually, I think that the most serious market reaction actually was not in equities, it was in bonds. Mm. Because basically, you know, the kind of things he was, the disruption he was threatening, if you like, you know, by ratcheting up the demands for higher and higher tariffs, particularly against China, you know, obviously a major supplier to US industry. Actually, it was the bond market misbehaving that I think basically triggered a change of course and indicated that because you've got to remember that the US is now highly indebted, 122% plus government debt to GDP ratio, which is sort of uncomfortable, and it relies profoundly on flows of foreign savings in order to actually fund that deficit. And so the fact that the dollar went down and bond yields actually rose rather than fall, because normally, basically, in a risk-off event, the dollar would rally and bonds would also rally, and equities would sell off. That would have started. This time around, that didn't happen. And Trump, well, certainly his advisors were pretty concerned about that. And that has, I think triggered him to sort of pull back and to realize that, actually banging the table like this, does have, could plunge the US economy ultimately into recession, primarily if things like the bond market misbehaves.
Yes, yes, the bond market was terribly, terribly interesting because it's the biggest market in the world. We can't even begin to comprehend its vastness. Well, I can't. And it sold off. In other words, the bond market sold off. And as there's a relationship where when bonds come off, yields go up, or when yields go up, bonds come down, yields went up. Bond prices came down, and as at the same time, as you quite rightly said, equities were coming down. And you don't see that very often. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen it to such a correlated extent in my time in the financial markets. So there's one safe haven gone, the US Treasury market. Other bonds did rather well, or relatively well, out of it. The dollar used to be a safe haven. That tumbled a little bit excessively and probably will recover a bit, but nonetheless, it tumbled. The only thing that seems to have done well in my next category, which was the safe haven, is gold, which has been astonishing. 3,500 plus at one stage, Philip.
Yes. Well, of course, it's... It's a barometer, if you like, of this trend towards deglobalization. And gold this time around, this particular cycle, prior to this particular sort of strong move, further move up, has really been driven by central bank buying. And you can date that really back to sort of when things started to go wrong, the first Russian invasion of Ukraine, where they took over the Crimea. And then basically we sort of kicked off again after the second Russian invasion of Ukraine. The Europeans froze the Russians' foreign exchange reserves that were held in euros predominantly. And of course, basically that means that, it's a signal that, when you need to get hold of your reserves, you need to get hold of your reserves. And if they're going to be frozen, by a hostile power, then it's not going to do you much good when you actually need that money. And so therefore we've seen, significant move to diversify using gold, on the part of central banks around the world, in order to reduce their reliance on the US and US capital markets. So that has been a sort of principal driver behind gold. And then, of course, Trump ratcheting the conflict up, again suggests that there's going to be an acceleration in this process of, global unraveling, if you like. And that basically, and the failure of other assets to actually provide protective characteristics has basically, supercharged gold.
Let's look at a couple of sideshows now. And when I say sideshows, I don't mean to trivialise them at all, but the Gaza situation. The first thing he said was, I think he woke up one morning and he said, goodness me, look at the water, as he calls it there. In other words, the beachfront. Look at the potential here, because the place is ruined. And I can turn it, or myself and my partners can turn it into the Riviera of the Middle East. And instead of thinking about it and talking about it rationally, as his father would have done, if you read the book Lucky Losers, you get an idea that his father was a meticulous man when it came to numbers. And only when every I was dotted and T was crossed and all those other things would he put an ad in the paper and say, these apartments available for rent and so on. Whereas his son, he's more he thinks that the name Trump and the cult of celebrity will help, even though he's got absolutely no plan. And that's the first thing. Then there was the 24 hours, the Ukraine-Russia war will be solved, and that failed. I don't know, Philip. The sideshows are somewhat disturbing to me.
So I think that you shouldn't get too carried away. He basically he shoots from the hip verbally a lot of the time, and he says things that, you know, that aren't really serious, and people take them too seriously.
Why does he say them if he knows they're not serious? Because he obviously knows they're not serious.
Because he wants to get a reaction, and he wants to get to be center of attention in social media, because that's worked for him. The fact that it's sort of, you know, he's a president and this is not particularly what we'd expect from somebody who would like to be seen as a statesman in a conventional sense is just the reality of Donald Trump. But to say he doesn't have a plan, I think is wrong. I think that there is evidence that there are a series of objectives. Mm. And in the same way that in his first administration, he basically started to force the unraveling of what we used to call Chimerica, the integration of the Chinese and the American economies. And, you know, frankly, he was right about that. He didn't do it particularly effectively because China has gone on to get a lot stronger subsequently. He said enough was enough, and then the Biden administration followed that policy and actually made it even tougher. So, and if we look at what he's trying to do at the moment, you know, he's 100 days in. You know, we reckon he's got sort of, you know, political inertia is going to set in. He's going to be able to do very little, certainly after the first 2 years, and arguably, you know, sort of 200 days in, if you haven't really sort of got momentum, then that's going to be tough. And he's got ambitious plans to actually, you know, reshape America's defense commitments, to address the problem of sustainability of the debt. So he's got a number of things he wants to achieve. You might not like the way that he's going about it, and it may well be that the way he's going about it is counterproductive, which will prevent him from achieving his objectives. But he has got a series of objectives that he's trying to get on with, and you know, I suspect he will, you know, ultimately succeed in part. But he's got to be careful, clearly, to not get too carried away, because basically to see further substantial weakness in the equity market, you know, he's going to damage his popularity and damage his ability to actually get stuff done.
Speaking of damage, a lot of people are saying it doesn't matter what he does now. It doesn't matter if he cuts Chinese tariffs from 145% down to 25%. A lot of the damage has already been done. It's going to be difficult to undo. Do you believe that in his first 100 days, a good deal of damage has been done and a good deal of confidence in the United States and the United States administration has been shattered?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the people really now get the fact that that there's going to be a serious reset in global geopolitics, in things like defense spending, and the willingness and indeed the ability of the US to play this role of sort of global number one. You know, they're saying, right, we cannot sustain sort of imperial America in the style that we've, you know, been used to after the Second World War. And if you have a problem with that, then clearly a lot of people are shocked. You've got German politicians weeping and all this kind of stuff. But come on, this is reality. The rise of China, you know, and I think you can sort of over-egg the fact that they're sort of this sort of evil empire and so forth, led by communists, etc., wanting to take over the world. But they represent a very serious geoeconomic and geopolitical threat to the US. And the US basically is trying to get its act together. Well, Trump is trying to make America great again, i.e. what does that actually mean? Well, it's to actually sort itself out so that it can compete effectively with China. That's really the thing. And, he's managed to upset his allies and this, that, and the other. But a lot of his allies have literally been enjoying an unlevel playing field. You know, they haven't been paying enough for defense. They've got sneaky tariffs. This idea that we're in this wonderful world, seamless world of free trade, I mean, is a sort of, it's a nonsense, you know. Okay, tariffs were relatively low, but there are lots of exceptions. And there are a lot of non-tariff barriers and so forth. And by and large, you know, the US sort of was prepared to put up with that because, you know, certain sections of US society actually did pretty well out of it. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, the absorbing China, you know, a typical sort of, you know, dirigiste type economy with a lot of state intervention, you know, it was just too big and too successful. So now the system has to change. And that's the important thing. You know, tariffs is as a peripheral thing. I don't think that, you know, tariffs as a sort of, as a weapon, you know, is it really going to, are they really going to be that effective? They're going to raise a bit of money because, you know, when all the dust settles, I think we passed peak tariffs or peak tariffs in rhetoric. Then, you know, you are going to have tariffs, maybe 10% or something like that across the board in the US, which is, you know, which is like a tax, you know, and American consumers will be paying some of that. The US, you know, needs more revenues because otherwise the budget deficit problem is going to get worse, which will leave the country more vulnerable.
Okay, let's have a look at another few things. We can't go into each one in any great detail, but we can look at the Panama Canal. We can look at Canada and Greenland. You can look at some of the appointees. I mean, the most notable one at the moment in the news is Pete Hegseth, who is the defense secretary. He's clearly out of his depth. Again, my opinion. So it just all comes together at the same time. I mean, there's the really meaty stuff, which you've beautifully described, and maybe he does have a plan. I really hope he does. And then there's the other stuff, which really annoys people, Philip. And I don't want to be annoyed by the most powerful man in the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm afraid, Lindsay, you know, that is your lot in life, and I can't really do very much about that.
No, but you can explain it to me. You can explain it to me, Philip, and then so at the end, is, you're going to tell me how to take advantage of it,
of
course.
The thing is that this time around, he's appointed his people. Some will fail, and some will succeed. And I suspect that, you know, Besant, as U.S. Treasury Secretary, you know, will turn out to be a very good appointment.
Yes.
And he certainly pulled Trump back from the brink. He understands markets in a way that Yellen, his predecessor, you know, was sort of hopelessly out of depth. And, you know, Hegseth, basically, if he isn't up to the job, he's going to get fired. You know, maybe he... You know, he peaked as an anchor on Fox News, and it was a bad appointment. You know, Trump, you know, he doesn't go down with the ship if somebody isn't performing. So I wouldn't get too hung up about Mr.
I can't help it. I turn on the television, I get hung up on little things like that. It's just like his cabinet meetings. He's got everyone recorded, and he sits there, the emperor, wearing no clothes. And it's like in the old days, I don't know if you're a channel surfer, if you sit at home after a long day's toil at 91 in London, productive. But you want to watch something. And so you go through the channels. There's nothing there. Click, 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 click. In the old days, it used to be court jesters. You'd sit there and a number of court jesters would be waiting in the wings. And you say, right, you're on. Go and make him laugh, will you? And he dances around and does some juggling and whatever. And the emperor claps. And so it goes on. Some are rubbish. What he does with the cabinet meeting, he goes, right, you. And they say, Mr. President, I just want to thank you for doing everything you said you'd do in this. And this sycophantic spew of praise. And it's just like that. And I don't know. I can't see leaders of the past doing that. And I can't help but be annoyed. I'm going to have to go and see someone about it, I think.
I think clearly. So we've got to ask ourselves, yeah, I get that, and that's the reaction of a lot of people. They scratch their heads and think, you know, this is, well, I mean, this is the kind of behavior we'd expect from Putin. where sort of some sort of unfortunate general has to come and sort of spout nonsense and so forth on Russian TV. But just think about it a moment. I mean, Stump is, you know, an unusual person. He's not a typical politician, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, you know, despite the fact that a lot of people, a lot of the electorate in the US, you know, have your kind of feelings about him, he got elected with a significant majority. And so why was that? Well, it's
promises.
Basically, you know, it's no, I don't think it's just promises. I think it's because it's a rejection of the existing political establishment, which has, you know, left America vulnerable, made a lot of poor choices, which has resulted in extraordinary degrees of inequality in the U.S. The haves obviously have a lot more. The have-nots basically haven't had it. You know, it just hasn't worked for them for many years. So globalization, you know, has been great for the few. It has been less great for the majority. And this is a rebalancing, and this is a rejection of the existing political order. And, you know, that's put a populist, a demagogue like Trump, in power, whereas previously he wouldn't have stood a chance.
Before we get on to what to do now, Philip, the most important part of our conversation,
sure.
One of the reasons he got elected is because of the cost of living crisis. And even though inflation was coming down, inflation was still there, 2.5%, 3.5%, whatever it is. And he said, I'm going to bring down the price of eggs. And he had a little table in front of him with lots of different staples and biscuits and everything else. Not that he's ever been in a grocery store, of course, but that doesn't matter. I don't mind that whatsoever. If I never have to go in one again, it'll be too soon. But the point is that the price of eggs, he keeps on saying the price of eggs is falling. It's not. The price of eggs is as high as it's ever been. In fact, in March, it was 6.3% higher, I think. So he said, I'm going to make things better and things are going to be cheaper, but he hasn't. And people forget about that.
You've got to give him more than 100 days. I mean,
why?
You know, you're talking of moving a super tanker. There's so, you know, this idea that you can have sort of instant gratification. Is just sort of naive. You know, China at least has the has, you know, stability in terms of government, continuity in terms of government. The
yes.
US is you know, you've got midterms coming up in 2 years, less than 2 years now, and then basically, you know, probably lose control of at least one of the houses, and then basically another year after that, it's presidential election campaigning season again. So it's really difficult to actually achieve anything. And sure, you know, you've got this. He has is using a lot of executive powers in a sort of, you know, somewhat dubious way, it has to be said. But he's doing that simply because basically it's the only way to get anything done, given the endemic inertia of the U.S. political system. Hence the urgency of doing deals and being seen to make progress and all this kind of stuff.
I wish him well, Philip.
The opportunity to make real changes, you know, is going to narrow pretty significantly.
I wish him well. I really, really do. I like to be annoyed by him. It's a sick sort of perversion that I have. But I do agree that he has, in his own special little way, some sort of plan somehow. It's just somebody's got to take him aside, like the Treasury Secretary, and say, look, why don't we do this, Mr. President? I think it's a really good idea you've got, but maybe we could just tweak it just a little bit. But will they say it? I don't know. I hope he's successful, and I hope you're successful as well at 91. And if so, how do you plan to be? Where does it go from here? At the moment, as we record this podcast, the US market's having a second lovely day.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, obviously markets got oversold, you know, the reaction to what was going on, the uncertainty and the sort of poor positioning of market participants. And so you've seen this sort of brutal unwinding of positions. And that's now settling down a bit. And so really the sort of, you know, we can have a US recession or not. And that sort of, you know, rather depends on where we end up tariff-wise. It depends on the underlying strength of the economy, because we think that corporate sector is in pretty good shape. actually consumer balance sheets are in pretty good shape. And of course, the Fed has got a lot of scope to cut interest rates if things get weak. So the market, I think, is sort of recognizes that, you know, we're sort of in this sort of corrective phase and we'll have rallies and we'll have relapses and so forth. But unless something new comes out of the woodwork, then we're in this sort of sideways kind of environment. However, there is a big thing going on, and that is that there's far too much international crowding in U.S. assets. You know, foreign investors basically had thrown the towel in, you know, and were being dragged more and more into U.S. assets, you know, as they became larger constituents of the sort of typical indices that people people use, like the MSCI, All Countries, you know, World Index. And so that now, I mean, I think that really what this recent period, you know, the significance of it is that it's marked an inflection point in what we labeled as U.S. exceptionalism, you know, exceptional relative outperformance, you know, that had been seriously overdone. So we're now seeing basically a sort of rotation out of U.S. assets, a rebalancing, if you like, as international investors sort of, you know, rebalance their risk exposures. And you're also seeing a rotational move within markets and the stocks that really benefited from the sort of hyper-globalized world, you know, they're the ones that are potentially looking vulnerable now. So we have hit an inflection point. You know, we may be in a corrective phase for markets for some months now. But coming out of that, I suspect that, you know, the Chinese are going to stimulate more. The Europeans are already stimulating their economies to sort of offset the effect of tariffs and so forth, and also to address the problem of, you know, sort of sluggish, very sluggish growth. Energy prices are coming down. That's actually sort of quite constructive. So I think we will come out of this funk, you know, whatever, you know, however, you know, whatever Trump's rhetoric. And I think he will continue to fascinate you.
Good.
I'm sure he will keep you glued and channel hopping to make sure you get your daily dose of Trump.
Oh, yes, please.
But we are sort of, you know, the hysteria of the level of uncertainty is going to reduce. Volatility is likely to reduce. We will have some tariff deals, I suspect. We've passed peak tariffs. And the world will not come to an end.
So it's time to maybe tentatively have a look at the ground, because you're already sitting on the fence at the moment. Tentatively look at stepping off that fence and dipping your toe into the water. Would you say that? Selectively, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, a lot of US assets are heavily oversold now. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing basically a sort of a rebound from those oversold positions. And a lot of the moves we've seen have been driven by shorter-term market operators and, you know, that have been squeezed and wrongly positioned, obviously, with, you know, often with high levels of leverage. So it's you get these weird market movements. So bond yields going up was obviously not what the risk systems were saying. And you heard all about the sort of basis trade unraveling and so forth in bond markets. So I think that phase has gone. Markets have been, you know, positions have been cleaned out. And so it's now, you know, longer term investors are going to be looking at this and thinking, well, we've probably got too much in the way of US exposure. So they're going to be selling rallies. And there will be rallies, pretty powerful rallies to be seen. And you know, but I suspect basically there won't be follow through. And then if you look at China and Europe, you know, by and large, a lot will depend on, you know, the level of stimulus, whether markets are prepared to look through it. And then of course, obviously, there's considerable scope for sort of interest rates to come down further, not just in the US, but you know, the Chinese are easing their position. ECB cut rates the other day. The Bank of England will probably cut rates next month when it meets. So you've got this sort of synchronized global reduction in short-term interest rates, which ultimately is going to underpin growth. So I think we come out of this. It just depends on basically, you know, how, you know, what level of weakness we've got to actually sort of get through in the nearer term.
Saunders with his soothing words. Philip Saunders is director at the Investment Institute at 91 in London. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position or opinion of any other agency, organisation, employer or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.